And so, in closing, here's the late, great Lowell George, reminding you to...
To a, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
and the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody, welcome aboard Foxed Up here for a Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, or Wednesday afternoon, all depending on where you reside on this beautiful blue marble, such that it still is. We're going to continue the Monsanto thing in a bit, but we're first going to get to the track of the day, and this stems from the conversation that I had with David last night, and you know, he rang in because I was playing Parliament, and we ended up getting to other things, and we talked about Tool, and he mentioned this video clip on YouTube explaining the mathematics behind a track titled Lateralis off of the album Lateralis. Now, I went and checked out this video clip, and if you haven't seen it, after the show, go to the Head On Radio Network forum, and you'll be able to find it there. And the guy who did this video clip has done a beautiful job in explaining the mathematics behind it. Now, people are like, math and music, what are you talking about? Well, music is math. Everything about it is mathematical. Rhythm is mathematical. Musical scales are mathematical. And the Fibonacci sequence, the Fibonacci numbers, are something found like virtually everywhere in nature. For being a bit of a math junkie myself, you know, I love physics, I love that kind of stuff. This particular sequence is fascinating, and I'm at the Fibonacci number wiki page, and they explain it very simply. They say, in mathematics, the Fibonacci numbers are a sequence of numbers named after Leonardo of Pisa, known as Fibonacci. Fibonacci's 1202 book, Libra Abaci, or Abaci, introduced the sequence to Western Europe mathematics, although the sequence has been previously described in Indian mathematics, going back like centuries. And it works this way. The first number in the sequence is zero. The second number is one. Each of the subsequent numbers is equal to the sum of the previous two numbers. So you start with 0 and 1, you add those together, and you get 1. So 0, 1, 1. So the last two now are 1 and 1. You add those together, you get 2. So 0, 1, 1, 2. Now the last two numbers are 2 and 1. You add those two to get 2 together. 0, 1, 1, 2, 3. And then it goes 5, 8, 13, and so on. Now, the Fibonacci sequence, you can find, it's also known as the golden ratio. The sequence is basically the ratio generally of the notes in the Western music 12-note scale. It is also what you will find in the, you know, you look at a leaf and you look at the way the little sprigs in the leaf break off. That all happens to the Fibonacci sequence. Now, legend has it that when Fibonacci or Leonardo of Pisa first came up with it, he came up with it dealing with the replication of rabbits, and this all works out. It also, you know, a seashell, the way that the shell spirals out is to the Fibonacci ratio. Same thing with galaxies. I mean, it goes on and on and on. This is a natural, you know, I've said it before. Mathematics is the language that nature uses to explain itself to us. And when this track first came out, now I'm a drummer of many years. Now I haven't played in a number of years, but I've studied drums and percussion for like almost 20 years solid. And I always had a thing for, you know, progressive and arty bands, because they usually got outside of the standard time signatures of straight four, boom, ksh, boom, ksh, boom, ksh, stuff. You know, so I enjoyed bands like Yes and Rush and, you know, Crack the Sky is another one. They do a lot of stuff, you know, in 5 and 7 and 9 and 11. Where it takes a little bit more thought than just sitting back to a backbeat. And to be brilliant with it is to make it naturally groove. You know, you know Money from Yes? That is, if memory serves me right, in 9-8. Or it might even switch between 9-8 and 7-8. But anyway, when Lateralis first came out, as I mentioned on yesterday's show, my good friend Scott Berry, Mr. B1 Louder himself, comes in with the Lateralis CD and says, you know, behold, revere me, I have Lateralis. And so we put it in, we played it. And we're listening to much of it, you know, a lot of it's in 5-4 or 10-8. And that was all pretty easy to figure out, some stuff in straight 4 time. Then the track Lateralis comes up, and I spent a good 2-3 weeks listening to this track over and over and over again, because it's a personal challenge for me, trying to find what meter the song is in, and I'm going crazy. I cannot find a center to this thing, but yet I can hear when it repeats, I can hear when it comes to the end of a cycle and begins another. But I cannot find a counting system that makes it work. So one day, Scott rings me up from work, and he says, I have the answer. And a mathematician at this audio production house had figured it out. And what they had done is designed the song around the Fibonacci number sequence, where the number of beats per measure change every measure to the Fibonacci number sequence. Now this just, you know, you hear me say this, you're going, what the hell does this all mean? Well, I'm not exactly sure what it means, but it makes for a very unique piece of music. It's long. And in the video that is on the forum, the guy even says, you know, you might be asking when this song ends, but that's the point. The whole idea of this Fibonacci number sequence is accepting randomness and spiraling out and finding something new. And this thing, just when you can't think that it can't get any bigger, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and goes to new places. And to not have you sit there and count beats during it, the lyric also plays in the number sequence. I've covered this before, but I'm doing a little bit more in depth than I have in the past. First, just to give a little explanation from the action, there's a Wikipedia page on this song. It says the Fibonacci sequence shares a relationship with spirals, which are mentioned several times later in the lyrics. The time signatures of the chorus change from 9/8 to 8/8 to 7/8. As drummer Danny Carey says, it was originally titled 9/8/7 for those time signatures. Then it turned out that 9/8/7 was the 17th step in the Fibonacci sequence. Pretty cool, eh? That wasn't their intention, but hey. It again kind of shows the amazing relationship that the golden ratio has with this. And the lyric begins, and the amount of syllables in each stanza goes with the Fibonacci sequence. So it's black, then white R, all I see, in my infancy, so it's 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, red and yellow, then came to be, then it turns back around, reaching out to me, 5, lets me see, 3, then it continues on, there is, 2, so, 1, much, 1, more that, beckons me, to look through to these, infinite possibilities. As below, so above and beyond, I imagine. It goes further. It goes to 13, then back down to 8. Drawn outside the lines of reason, push the envelope, 5. Watch it bend, 3. And the whole idea is about, the whole song is a very, shall we say, metaphysical concept of what pushing the boundaries of one's consciousness are. And that it can take you to new places. And they have a note here. They say, in a 2001 interview, Keenan, the singer, commented on the lyric mentioning black, white, red, and yellow. I used the archetype stories of North American Aboriginals and the themes or colors of which appear over and over again in the oral stories handed down through generations. Black, white, red, and yellow play very heavily in Aboriginal stories of creation. It's the same thing with the Australian Aboriginals. This is an amazing piece of music. And for those that aren't into the big, loud guitar thing, if you take into account the thought that goes into this, it might make you listen through the big noise and realize how much thought and care and experimentation go into something like this. And this is what, you know, I go off of that Tool fairly often because I think that they're so rare in music. You know, just like Parliament, just like other bands that make things that are timeless and truly unique, just like the Drive-By Truckers. Now, they're not, you know, mathematically over-the-top technical like Tool are, but there's a similar honesty in the creativity in trying to go somewhere. Now, one of the things that still blows me away about this track, there's a section in the middle. You know, this is a four-piece band. Drums, bass, guitar, and vocal. There's one point where they're playing what they call, they're playing in the world of what might be known as polyrhythm. One, the drums are playing in a straight four time. I think it's the bass is playing in three beats per measure. And I think the bass is playing in five beats per measure, and the lyric might be in two. And they're playing over one another. So it creates these different circles of time circling around the same center, which again is playing with the concepts of Fibonacci and consciousness in general. I just think it's brilliant. So sit back, don't worry about counting too much, but you know, count the first verse and you'll see what I mean. The black then white are all I see in my infancy. And at the end of the song, there's this whole, it builds to a point. Go to the lyric here. It says, I embrace my desire to feel the rhythm, to feel connected enough to step aside and weep like a widow, to feel inspired, to fathom the power, to witness the beauty, to bathe in the fountain, to swing on the spiral, to swing on the spiral, to swing on the spiral of our divinity and still be a human. With my feet upon the ground, I move myself between the sounds and open wide to suck it in. I feel it move across my skin. I'm reaching up and reaching out. I'm reaching for the random or whatever will bewilder me. And whatever will bewilder me, and following our will and wind, we may go where no one's been. We'll ride the spiral to the end and may just go where no one's been. Spiral out, keep going. Because it's endless. So I think I babbled on enough about it. And like I said, after the show, check out this video clip at the forum. And it'll all kind of come together. And you'll be able to, and you'll see also in the thread, we posted links to Alex Gray, the artist that does a lot of their stuff, and a couple of the video clips that they've actually done with artists with Alex Gray's animation work. And you get the idea of what David and I were talking about, how working on the idea of a complete art package, not just the music, but the atmosphere, the visual arts, the whole thing. So, without further ado, the title track from Lateralis 2001 Tool. Hit it, Bob. I still reckon one of my favorite noises of all time. I just never get tired of that track. I never get tired of that album. And, you know, there's a reason why Tool albums take sometimes 5 years to be completed. You know, you just cannot do that stuff in a jam session. You know, it's just, yeah. And so now that I've made all your ears bleed, we'll move on to some green stuff. But, you know, I've covered the song before, and in fact, I did a piece for Billy Shears a year or so ago, actually, on that when he was doing his bit where he was having different hosts do a spotlight on a song, and my piece, which you can probably still find at his website, on why is music important. And I use this song as an example of how a song can open up the mind to things aside from just a mundane lyric. You know, how many kids, how many teenage kids who, through message boards, were exposed to the concept of Fibonacci, suddenly got a new interest in mathematics in a way that they wouldn't have found if it hadn't been for the fact that this big, loud, progressive, pounding metal band, which I use metal band lightly, really they're a progressive rock band, you know, if it hadn't been for that, for thinking that highly of the audience, to absorb something that on its surface is just a mad piece of composition. When you look deeper and research it, you know, and some people say, oh, it's all overanalyzing. Well, if everything's got to be spoon-fed and vanilla, I think life is boring. Anywho, now that we've blown 25 minutes of the show on one song. But check out the clip, because in real time, there's this great explanation. Head on radionetwork.com/forum, and you'll find the Fibonacci thread. And like I said, also check out Alex Gray's artwork, Tool's artist of the last couple of records, and incredibly unique stuff. Some of it's rather confronting, too. Amazing stuff. And I posted a couple of video clips that have used the clip for Vicarious, which is the opening track to 10,000 Days, the most recent release, is the most anti-MTV video I've seen in a long, 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 long time. But I got into Monsanto yesterday, and I've got this piece from Vanity Fair, and you can check out yesterday's show post to actually get the link. Monsanto's Harvest of Fear. And, I mean, this is food. We're talking about food here. After we've gotten past, you know, food for the ears, nutrition for the brain. We're talking about actually what we're putting into our bodies and not given a choice over. Gary Reinhart, I'm just going to read straight from the article. Gary Reinhart clearly remembers the summer day in 2002 when the stranger walked in and issued his threat. Reinhart was behind the counter of the Square Deal, his old-time country store, as he calls it, on the fading town square of Eaglesville, Missouri, a tiny farm community 100 miles north of Kansas City. The Square Deal is a fixture in Eagleville, a place where farmers and townspeople go for light bulbs, greeting cards, hunting gear, ice cream, aspirin, and dozens of other small items without having to drive to a big-box store in Bethany, the county seat 15 miles down Interstate 35. Everyone knows Reinhart, who was born and raised in the area and runs one of Eagleville's few surviving businesses. The stranger came up to the counter and asked for him by name. "Well, that's me," said Reinhart. As Reinhart would recall, the man began verbally attacking him, saying he had proof that Reinhart had planted Monsanto's genetically modified soybeans in violation of the company's patent. "Better come clean and settle with Monsanto," Reinhart says the man told him, "or face the consequences." Reinhart was incredulous, listening to the words as puzzled customers and employees looked on. Like many others in rural America, Reinhart knew of Monsanto's fierce reputation for enforcing its patents and suing anyone who allegedly violated them. But Reinhart wasn't a farmer. He wasn't a seed dealer. He hadn't planted any seeds or sold any seeds. He owned a small, a really small, country store in a town with 350 people. He was angry that somebody could just barge into the store and embarrass him in front of everyone. "It made me and my business look bad," he says. Reinhardt says he told the intruder, "You got the wrong guy." When the stranger persisted, Reinhardt showed him the door. On the way out, the man kept making threats. Reinhardt says he can't remember the exact words, but they were the effect of, "Monsanto is big, you can't win. We will get you, you will pay." Scenes like this are playing out in many parts of rural America these days as Monsanto goes after farmers, farmers' co-ops, seed dealers, and anyone is suspects may have infringed its patents of genetically modified seeds. As interviews and reams of court documents reveal, Monsanto relies on a shadowy army of private investigators and agents in the American heartland to strike fear into farm country. They fan out into fields and farm towns. They secretly videotape and photograph farmers, store owners, and co-ops, infiltrate community meetings, and gather information from informants about farming activities. Farmers say that some Monsanto agents pretend to be surveyors. Others confront farmers on their land and try to pressure them to sign papers giving Monsanto access to the private records. Farmers call them the seed police and use words such as Gestapo and Mafia to describe their tactics. When asked about these practices, Monsanto declined to comment specifically other than to say that the company is simply protecting its patents. Monsanto spends more than $2 million a day in research to identify, test, develop, and bring to market innovative new seeds and technologies that benefit farmers. Monsanto spokesman Darren Wallace wrote in an emailed letter to Vanity Fair, "One tool in protecting this investment is patenting our discoveries and, if necessary, legally defending those patents against those who might choose to infringe upon them." Wallace said that while the vast majority of farmers and seed dealers follow the licensing agreements, a tiny fraction do not, and that Monsanto is obliged to those who do abide by its rules to enforce its patent rights on those who reap the benefits of the technology without paying for its use. He said only a small number of cases ever go to trial. Some compare Monsanto's hard-lined approach to Microsoft's zealous efforts to protect its software from pirates. At least with Microsoft, the buyer of a program can use it over and over again. But farmers who buy Monsanto seeds can't even do that. The control of nature. For centuries, millennia, farmers have saved seeds from season to season. They planted in the spring, harvested in the fall, then reclaimed and cleared and cleaned the seeds over the winter for replanting the next spring. Monsanto has turned this ancient practice on its head. Monsanto developed GM seeds that would resist its own herbicide, Roundup, offering farmers a convenient way to spray fields with weed killer without affecting crops. Monsanto then patented the seeds. For nearly all of its history, the United States Patent and Trademark Office had refused to grant patents on seeds, viewing them as life forms with too many variables to be patented. "It is not like describing a widget," says Joseph Mendelson III, a legal director of the Center for Food Safety, which has tracked Monsanto's activity in rural America for years. Indeed not. But in 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, turned seeds into widgets, laying the groundwork for a handful of corporations to begin taking control of the world's food supply. In its decision, the court extended patent law to cover a live, human-made microorganism. In this case, the organism wasn't even a seed. Rather, it was the Pseudomonas bacterium developed by General Electric scientists to clean up oil spills. But the precedent was set, and Monsanto took advantage of it. Since the 1980s, Monsanto has become the world's leader in genetic modification of seeds and has won 674 biotechnology patents, more than any other company, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture data. Farmers who buy Monsanto's patented Roundup Ready seeds are required to sign an agreement promising not to save the seed produced after each harvest for replanting or to sell the seed to other farmers. This means that farmers must buy new seed every year. Those increased sales, coupled with ballooning sales of its Roundup weed killer, have been a bonanza for Monsanto. This radical departure from age-old practice has created turmoil in farm country. Some farmers don't fully understand that they aren't supposed to save Monsanto seeds for next year's planting. Others do, but ignore the stipulation rather than throw away perfectly usable product. Still, others say they don't use Monsanto's genetically modified seeds, but seeds have been blown into the fields by wind or deposited by birds. It's certainly easy for GM seeds to get mixed in with traditional varieties when seeds are cleaned by commercial dealers for replanting. The seeds looked identical. Only a laboratory analysis can show the difference. Even if a farmer doesn't buy GM seeds and doesn't want them on his land, it's a safe bet he'll get a visit from Monsanto's seed police if crops grown from GM seeds are discovered in his fields. Most Americans know Monsanto because of what it sells to put on our lawns. It's ubiquitous weed killer Roundup. What they may not know is the company now profoundly influences and one day may virtually control what we put on our tables. For most of its history, Monsanto was a chemical giant, producing some of the most toxic substances ever created, residues of which have left us with some of the most polluted sites on Earth. Yet, in little more than a decade, the company has sought to shed its polluted past and morph into something much different and far more far-reaching. An agricultural company dedicated to making the world a better place for future generations. Still, more than one weblog claims to see similarities between Monsanto and the fictional company U-North in the movie Michael Clayton, an agribusiness giant accused of in a multi-billion dollar lawsuit of selling an herbicide that causes cancer. Monsanto's genetically modified seeds have transformed the company and are radically altering global agriculture. So far, the company has produced GM seeds for soybeans, corn, canola, and cotton. Many more products have been developed and are in the pipeline, including seeds for sugar beets and alfalfa. The company is also seeking to extend its reach into milk production by marketing an artificial growth hormone for cows that increases their output, and it is taking aggressive steps to put those who don't want to use the growth hormone at a commercial disadvantage. Even as the company is publishing its GM agenda, Monsanto is buying up conventional seed companies. Here's where it gets truly evil, folks. In 2005, Monsanto paid $1.4 billion for Seminis, which controlled 40% of the U.S. market for lettuce, tomatoes, and other vegetables and fruit seeds. 2 weeks later, it announced the acquisition of the country's third largest cottonseed company, Emergent Genetics, for $300 million. It estimated that Monsanto seeds now account for 90% of the U.S. production of soybeans, which are used in food products beyond counting. Monsanto's acquisitions have fueled explosive growth, transforming the St. Louis-based corporation into the largest seed company in the world. In Iraq, the groundwork has been laid to protect the patents of Monsanto and other GM seed companies. One of the L. Paul Bremer's last acts as head of the Coalition Provisional Authority was an order stipulating that farmers shall be prohibited from reusing seeds of protected varieties. Monsanto has said that it has no interest in doing business in Iraq. But should the company change its mind, the American-style laws are in place. To be sure, more and more agriculture corporations and individual farmers are using Monsanto's GM seeds. As recently as 1980, no genetically modified crops were grown in the U.S. in 2007. The total was 142 million acres planted. Worldwide, the figure was 282 million acres. Many farmers believe that GM seeds increase crop yields and save money. Another reason for their attraction is convenience. By using Roundup Ready soybean seeds, a farmer can spend less time tending to his fields. With Monsanto seeds, a farmer plants his crop, then treats it later with Roundup to kill weeds. That takes place of labor-intensive weed control and planting. Oh, God forbid they'd actually have to pay someone to weed the fields. Now, pulling away from the article, a lot of these claims that they've got are starting to prove false about the increased yields, especially when it comes to the BT cotton, the fact that they're resistant to certain parasites. Well, the parasite situation and fighting ability seems to wear out after a couple of months, and farmers are then, after having to spend money for this really expensive seed that they can't save and plant the next year, they then have to go back to Monsanto for the chemicals in which to fight the very parasites that the BT cotton was designed to resist. So they get to even profit again off of fraud. Now, Monsanto has a history of doctoring, if not outright falsifying, research records. I mentioned this last night. One of the biggest examples of this is in the 70s, the dioxin plant that exploded in West Virginia, where they moved exposed people from the exposed list to the controlled, not exposed list, and then released the data saying, well, the unexposed people had as much cancer rate and disease rate as the exposed people, so we're not responsible. And this ended up making it so that Vietnam veterans who came back from Vietnam with the effects of Agent Orange were denied care and benefits. This is a wholly evil operation, and they want to control the basic building blocks for food and human security. And you look at what's going on in Mexico, where these seeds are still illegal, just by nature doing its thing and cross-pollination and importing of U.S. GM corn product, they're finding and have verified these Monsanto genetically modified strains within ancient strains of Mexican corn. So what's going to happen? People who have spent generations maintaining, saving seed for these heirloom varieties of corn, due to the infiltration and Mother Nature's natural work, will end up having to pay Monsanto for planting the very stuff that they have been maintaining for centuries. Centuries. How is this right in any way, shape, or form? And you know they don't even they mention about the bovine growth hormone. They haven't even really mentioned in the article yet about the fact that this causes major health problems for cattle. You know, engorged udders.
But this is all just to get higher output. It's all about money and not actually doing any work to make that money. Look, I only want to hire 5 Mexicans instead of 20 because I don't want to have to pay them to pull them damn weeds.
Now, Australia has had a policy of no GM crops here. You can import the stuff, but as far as planting, but in New South Wales recently, this corrupt as hell New South Wales government has said that they're going to allow GM-modified canola crops. And there's quite the uprising about it, and I hope they're able to stop it, because this, you know, one of the beauties of Australia is the fact that it is this island nation. And so our quarantine is very, very tight. And so, that you know, our quarantine is very, very tight to help protect native species, animal, plant, whatever, from outside forces. I mean, we don't have rabies in this country. It doesn't exist. And, you know, there's a major, major cost saving in having very strict controls on quarantine to protect this isolated biosystem that is Australia. So if they go ahead with this plan to allow these people, you know, some farmers, who will buy into this idea of, you know, higher output, na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. And the farmer, you know, downwind, who wants to continue to grow non-GM crops and save his seed like he has done for generations maybe, ends up having his seed cross-pollinated, Monsanto will be able to extort money from him or her and destroy their livelihood and suck them dry. Because this is what Monsanto does. Back to the article here. Got a few minutes yet. Monsanto portrays its move into GM seeds as a giant step for mankind. But out in the American countryside, Monsanto's no-holds-barred tactics have made it feared and loathed. Like it or not, farmers say they have fewer and fewer choices in buying seeds. Yeah, so much for that free market thing and bringing choice. Bullshit. And controlling the seed is not some abstraction. Whoever provides the world's seeds controls the world's food supply. We get into surveillance. After Monsanto's investigator confronted Gary Reinhart, Monsanto filed a federal lawsuit alleging that Reinhart knowingly, intentionally, and willfully planted seeds in violation of Monsanto's patent rights. The company's complaint made it sound as if Monsanto had Reinhart dead to rights. During the 2002 growing season, investigator Jeffrey Moore, through surveillance of Mr. Reinhart's farm facility and farming operations, observed defendant planting brown bag soybean seed. Mr. Moore observed the defendant take the brown bag soybeans to a field, which was subsequently loaded into a grain drill and planted. Mr. Moore located two empty bags in the ditch in the public road right-of-way just beside one of the fields planted by Reinhart, which contained some soybeans. Mr. Moore collected a small amount of soybeans left in the bags which defendant had tossed into the public right-of-way. These samples tested positive for Monsanto's Roundup Ready technology. Faced with a federal lawsuit, Reinhart had to hire a lawyer. Monsanto eventually realized that investigator Jeffrey Moore had targeted the wrong man and dropped the suit. Reinhart later learned that the company had been secretly investigating farmers in his area. Reinhart never heard from Monsanto again. No letter of apology, no public concession that the company had made a terrible mistake, no offer to pay his attorney fees. I don't know how you get away with it, he says. If I tried to do something like that, it would be bad news. I felt like I was in another country. As much of America, my friend. Gary Reinhart is actually one of Monsanto's luckier targets. Ever since commercial introduction of its GM seeds in 1996, Monsanto has launched thousands of investigations and filed lawsuits against hundreds of farmers and seed dealers. In a 2007 report, the Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C. documented 112 such lawsuits in 27 states. Even more significant, in the center's opinion, are the number of farmers who settle because they don't have the money or time to fight Monsanto. The number of cases filed is only the tip of the iceberg, says Bill Fries, the center's science policy analyst. Fries says he has been told of many cases in which Monsanto investigators showed up at a farmer's house or confronted him in the fields, claiming he had violated the technology agreement and demanded to see his records. According to Fries, investigators will say, Monsanto knows that you are saving Roundup Ready seeds, and if you don't sign these information release forms, Monsanto is going to come after you and take your farm and take you for all you're worth. Investigators will sometimes show a farmer a photo of himself coming out of a store to let him know he's being followed. Does this not sound like the bloody, you know, this is Gestapo stuff? Lawyers who have represented farmers sued by Monsanto say that intimidating actions like these are commonplace. Most give in and pay Monsanto some amount in damages. Those who resist face the full force of Monsanto's legal wrath. And then there's the scorched earth tactics. Pilot Grove, Missouri, population 750, sits in a rolling farmland 150 miles west of St. Louis. The town has a grocery store, a bank, a bar, a nursing home, a funeral parlor, and a few other small businesses. There are no stoplights, but the town doesn't need any. The little traffic it has comes from trucks on their way to and from the grain elevator on the edge of town. The elevator is owned by a local co-op, the Pilot Grove Cooperative Elevator, which buys soybeans and corn from farmers in the fall, then ships out the grain over winter. The co-op has 7 full-time employees and 4 computers. In the fall of 2006, Monsanto trained its legal guns on Pilot Grove. Ever since, the farmers have been drawn into a costly, disruptive legal battle against an opponent with limitless resources. Neither Pilot Grove nor Monsanto will discuss the case, but it's possible to piece together much of the story from documents filed as part of the litigation. Monsanto began investigating soybean farmers in and around Pilot Grove several years ago. There is no indication as to what sparked the probe, but Monsanto periodically investigates farmers in soybean-growing regions such as this in central Missouri. The company has a staff devoted to enforcing patents and litigating against farmers. To gather leads, the company maintains an 800 number and encourages farmers to inform on other farmers they think may be engaging in seed piracy. Yeah, dial 1-800-ROUNDUP just to snitch on your neighbor. Once Pilot Grove had been targeted, Monsanto sent private investigators into the area. Over a period of months, Monsanto's investigators surreptitiously followed the co-op's employees and customers and videotaped them in fields and going about other activities. At least 17 such surveillance videos were made, according to court records. The investigative work was outsourced to a St. Louis agency, McDowell & Associates. It was a McDowell investigator who erroneously fingered Gary Reinhart. In Pilot Grove, at least 11 McDowell investigators have worked the case. And Monsanto makes no bones about the extent of this effort. Surveillance was conducted through the year by various investigators in the field, according to court records. McDowell, like Monsanto, will not comment on the case. Not long after investigators showed up in Pilot Grove, Monsanto subpoenaed the co-op's records concerning seeds and herbicide purchases and seed cleaning operations. The co-op provided more than 800 pages of documents pertaining to dozens of farmers. Monsanto sued 2 farmers and negotiated settlements with more than 25 others it accused of seed piracy, but Monsanto's legal assault had only begun. Although the co-op had provided volumes of records, Monsanto then sued in federal court for patent infringement. Monsanto contended that by cleaning seeds, a service which had been provided for decades, the co-op was inducing farmers to violate Monsanto's patents. In effect, Monsanto wanted the co-op to police its own customers. Even after Pilot Grove turned over thousands of more pages of sales records going back 5 years and covering virtually every one of its farmer customers, Monsanto wanted more. The right to inspect the co-op's hard drives. When the co-op offered to provide an electronic version of any record, Monsanto demanded hands-on access to Pilot Grove. How is it that a private company is allowed to do things that you would expect only from bloody the CIA or police? I mean, does this just smell of fascism to you? Business and the government becoming one. Business is now becoming the law enforcement of government, or the law enforcement of themselves. Ha! This stuff absolutely just makes me livid. Absolutely livid. I mean, this just goes on. And, you know, and this is the other part of this. The other part of this is, you know, Monsanto is on this massive, you know, quest to make everyone forget about their chemical past. They are a dangerous chemical manufacturer. They created Agent Orange. And I mean decades after the Vietnam War, the effects of Agent Orange are still shown on young children today. But yet, they can't be held accountable. I mean, this is just unabashed, uncontrolled freaking greed. At its absolutely worst levels. You know, we have our little veggie patch. I'm looking out the window, looking at it now. All the new stuff that's just starting to grow for winter. And, you know, we buy seeds from these organic seed outfits. And just how ludicrous it would be, the concept. And, I mean, and this is now accepted. How ludicrous it would be that the concept that, you know, I can buy a pack of spinach seeds, only use a portion of them, not even claiming seed from what we might harvest that year, but the fact that we might use unused seed. You know, this idea that there's like an expiry date on the license for seed. Just absolutely just does my head in. You know, as farmers didn't have enough to face with the changing climate, increased fuel and transportation costs, with mechanized farming that is beginning to suffer the effects of its own success. And we're going to allow one company to control not only 90% of the seed distribution in America, that's not even including what they do internationally, but let them have patents is just madness. Please go and check out on the show blog and read the rest of this article and go and watch The World According to Monsanto. Just Google it. You'll find it at Google Video. Shake it off. All right, I've had a bit of a rant. I've had a bit of a spew. But this is just awful stuff that's being done to those that try and feed the world. So thanks to Bob Kincaid for producing today. Thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society for the streaming and the archives. Thanks to Cold River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Thanks to Scott Berry at B1 Louder Productions for the music. And as we say here on Fox Stuff, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply. So I tucked my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why. He said, you look like a fine, upstanding young man. I think you do. So I took off my hat, I said, imagine that. Me working for you.